Tape two. Just about to flan now. Yep. One of the things that I want to ask you about, this has been a fascinating discussion thus far. I want to ask you about the Concept Union, your involvement with it, and the Theodore Adorno Jazz Quartet. Not necessarily in that order, and not necessarily all together, but I want to cover those things and have you wax encaustic or whatever about them.
Well, doing encaustic without wax is next to impossible.
There we are.
So I hope to start doing that very soon.
Yet another medium for you.
Exactly. Well, I've got the wax. I just need to get the pigment and figure out what the hell I'm doing. But don't we all? When I moved down to Atlanta, I had a lot of kind of swimmy notions in my mind. This interview will be pretty good evidence that many of the notions in my mind are still extremely swimmy.
Yeah. Don't sell yourself too short.
But one of the things that I had spent a lot of time dealing with in Chicago was the notion of the art of the everyday. And as I left Chicago, I realized that the one thing I hadn't done is developed an everyday.
Developed an everyday art or developed an everyday life?
Both, really. I hadn't developed any sort of rhythm of everyday, a sense of everyday life, insofar as it can exist as the erasure of things that are important. Or at least, you know, on one level, we really do sort of view it as the things that are forgettable. The things we do every day, and because we do them every day, they're not remarkable. But at the same time, without them, nothing is remarkable. They're sort of the backdrop against which the remarkable happens. And I kind of lost a lot of sense of what was remarkable and what wasn't. While I was in Chicago, I didn't have any kind of routine. And so I came down here with the idea that I was going to finally develop a sense of the everyday. And against that backdrop, start doing, and with an understanding of that backdrop, start doing art with an understanding of that. Well, turns out it's not entirely that simple. Everyday jobs rot your mind and they make you tired, which is a problem.
Yes.
Involved in all of that is some actual honest to God discipline. Oops. Who knew? But there you go. So, at the same time, involved in all of this was a very radical and rabid sense of self-reliance. I had relied on other people before, and it hadn't worked very well. And so I was very wary, especially of doing something as personal as art in a group of other people, and accepting help or advice or whatever. Well, that was pretty much out of the question.
Okay.
So, somewhere along the line, and I don't even remember where along the line, I'm going to announce at this point that it worked.
Good.
And I'm about to present you with the dessert that I planned.
Are you happy about that? Because I'm hungry.
It's even kind of attractive. I don't usually go in for visual presentation of food, which may sound really funny, but very often I've had one too many things that looked great and tasted lousy, and so I'm really dead set against going for the visual presentation. Like, people need to learn to close their eyes. So this, however, I'm kind of proud of. You want dessert, sir?
I would love some dessert, sir. Oh, right on.
And there's more of everything, so...
Good. Well,
you
need
that, you can have another.
But you were saying...
I had this vague idea when I moved down here that one of the things I was going to do was do all the art that I was neglecting while being a scholar. And in large part, totally failed to do that for the first couple little while. The big artistic breakthrough really came when... Yeah, I heard Kay was a painter, and I'd heard about painting, and, you know, I painted with my little basket, you know, with those little discs and things, and showed Kay the paper bag paintings. She showed up at my house a couple days later with a bucket of paint and a canvas and a brush or two.
So she encouraged you.
Yeah, in the perfect way. She walked in, dumped the materials there, said, have fun. And I said, wait, can you show me how to use these? She looked at me and said, no. You know how to use them. See you later. Which, you know, I've been drunk enough times that she's gotten to hear all about it. But really...
I didn't realize that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that...
Apparently, I haven't been drunk enough times, but go ahead.
It's odd. If she had actually even yielded to my request and come by and held my hand, I don't think anything would have come out of it. And the first couple of things I did sucked. But the whole aesthetic of her sitting there saying, here you go to it, really made me sort of wake up and realize that the media were there for the taking. I need to move these to the fridge now. It's starting to freeze. They're supposed to be chilled, not frozen. For the record, custard should be chilled, not frozen. But,
so Kay was encouraging in just the right way.
Yeah, exactly. And that really seemed to be the spirit that kind of developed out of that for me was the one that was carried on in a lot of the other shows that we did, too. It was very independently minded art, you know. I've always been wary... Or for a long time, I've been wary, or at least daunted, by art with a capital A. I've quit writing poems more times than I've quit drinking. Largely for that very reason. You know, I just sat there and said, you know, I'm never going to be able to do this well, so why am I bothering? And just quit. And suddenly, especially with the King Plow show, I at least caught an inkling of something else. In a lot of ways, it was kind of the folky ground up. My God, we're all having an identity crisis, sort of aesthetic that I've been talking about all this time. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, as well you know at this point, you know, when you had first started talking about a concept union, I really thought that my artistic notions were going to be subordinated to some bigger dream. And until I felt like I had a grasp on really what I wanted to do, or at least my own sovereignty as an artist, or for that matter, as a person, I wasn't going to be part of a group And somewhere along the line, I realized that sovereignty is not something that's bestowed or taken away in a very real sense. If it is, it's not sovereignty.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, frankly, if you're sovereign because somebody's letting you be sovereign, That's what it ain't. So, with that realization in tow, I saw, to me, the potential for the concept union was really a whole idea of grabbing art not by the tail but by the shoulders and kind of giving it a good shake and a good massage and saying, hey, you're one of me. And really being an opportunity to simultaneously develop, but sort of develop in a public way, and basically the idea that the concept union itself would be an ongoing, growing human work of art.
And I mean, I've said this before, one of the main...
Would you like another, by the way?
I would, yeah. One of the main impetuses for the concept union was when I realized that you were writing those little plays of yours,
mm-hmm.
those little performance pieces. Those totally blew me away. And I remember sitting after the car wreck with Kay and just realizing, you know, Alec is doing these little pieces. We need to put them on. And so the whole impetus behind the Hi Cockalorum show was because you did those little pieces, and I wanted to some extent, see those pieces actualized. You know, I wanted to see them in real life. I wanted to see what they looked like. And actually being able to do that, I mean, you were a real inspiration for me because you were doing it. I mean, you were actually doing art, and that just blew my mind. Even though you were doing it in your, you know, basically in your apartment to nobody at all, just the fact that you were doing it was such an inspiration to me.
Well, thank you for doggedly pursuing me, too, because
sure.
This is territory you and I have hashed well.
Yeah. But for posterity, so.
Yeah, I was extremely hesitant.
And rightfully so. I can be overbearing. Or haven't you noticed?
Well, part of it is, you know, we've been talking about art as an expression of identity. It seemed to me that you know, what you were trying to put together was this human work of art that was an expression of your identity. And I was like, wait. I'm a discrete entity. Mine. No thanks. So, you know, we were getting into some of that.
Yeah. I think that was a very important thing for me to hear at that point. I mean, I think that was a very necessary part of the process. And I'm very thankful for it.
And bear in mind, I was also coming at, you know...
Oh, thank you.
I've got your fork, too. One of the places that I was coming from, too, was the situation I had back in California where the person I felt closest and most similar to in the world suddenly started dating the person that I was dating. And so the whole idea of...
discrete entity.
Yeah. I was like, wait. I'm an interchangeable part with somebody else, except I'm the inferior in an interchangeable part. It was very strong in me at that point.
I understand.
And, so, I mean, yeah, there genuinely was some of that coming out, too.
Oh, yeah, it's fair.
I got more quirky shit out of that, whole disaster than, frankly, than I think anybody else did. I at least got decent art out of it.
Mm-hmm.
They got a dysfunctional relationship. I got art. I think I won.
Yeah, you got the better part of the deal, I'd say. You at least synthesized better. You survived better.
But if nothing else, you know, I had the gun to my head. In the, I mean, there was a point there where it really seemed to me that the logical conclusion was for me to not exist.
Ooh, ow.
And, I mean, I didn't... I got to that point and said, well, there's faulty logic in here somewhere.
Yeah, somewhere, yeah. Thankfully.
But, I mean, yeah, there was a point where I was just like, wait. If I'm the lesser of an interchangeable part, I don't feel like being a spare. That's when it occurred to me that maybe the system was just wrong. That maybe I wanted to be a part in a different engine somewhere. Thanks.
Welcome to Atlanta.
Exactly. Well, first it was welcome to Chicago. Yeah. Here's academia. Oops.
What?
Hello. The Theodore Adorno Jazz Quartet really started as a name. In my mind, I just thought that would be the funniest thing to call a band. Mm-hmm. Or just an entity. And just in the same way that a lot of the visual art I do is sort of a, if you will, a crisis of time, place, and person, all of which gets conflated. I thought a lot of that could be expressed theatrically. And it was not my initial intent that those ideas come out in these suit-wearing entities known as the Theodore Adorno Jazz Quartet. But that, at least, is the theatrical direction that that was important to me to go to when we actually started doing this. Mm-hmm. Or rather, that was where the very swimmy notions, indeed, that I had about music, art, and theater, that was the place they led me once we actually started doing this. Yeah, that's where, in my mind...
Well, it started out as very much a spoof. Where do you find that now? Is it still spoof, or has it taken on some higher art pretensions? I wonder about that a lot. Are we still spoofing, or are we actually trying to do something real now?
Well, I think there was always a level of well, first of all, in good postmodernism, spoof is high art. I mean, you can't get away from that. You know, if you're to believe a good postmodernist, anything you do now is either a conscious or unconscious spoof of something that somebody else did already anyway. And I think we were almost sick with that consciousness. And frankly, for that matter, I think we are almost just by being alive around here. Sick with that consciousness. And I think that was where a lot of the spoof aspect of the concept being the jazz quartet grew out of. That sort of sense of, you know, anytime you do anything, you're walking through somebody's theory. that we wanted to sit there and walk through theories and make fun of the theorizers for a little while. You know, anybody who has the arrogance to decide that jazz is worthless as perennial fashion or declare lyric poetry barbaric, bless his heart. I mean, that there is, there's a lot of that in there. At the same time, I really thought that we were also almost always seeking a level of abstraction. Um, you know, the fun of bringing thoroughly ordinary gestures on stage. You know, like making coffee. And I don't know if we bolted that on ex post facto or not, come to think of it, because when you look at the first show we did and many of the first rehearsals we did, it was all about making noise with random stringed instruments, even though we
and also random objects. Yeah.
Yeah. But the whole theatrical aspect was something that developed after the second show we did, Under the Couch. I genuinely think something, for lack of a better word, magical happened when we just sat down and hashed through that show, start to finish.
Mm-hmm. How so?
Just up until then, we had been so almost virulently improvisationally minded that I think we lost a little bit of track of one of the things that we were trying to do, which was make our audience just slightly uncomfortable. in a lot of ways, it's moving a little bit past some of the things that Beverly Brush tried to do. He would do things like have people roller skate across the stage holding up signs to wake you up and make sure that you were a detached audience. Mm-hmm. You know, he didn't want you to be sucked into the plot and the characters. He wanted you to be sitting there critically analyzing everything.
Always aware of this. So the willing suspension of disbelief didn't exist for Brecht.
Right, exactly. He spent a lot of time trying to subvert that, and that's one of the notions behind the epic theater. It should be entertaining, honest to God, but at no point are you supposed to suspend your critical thought. One of the things that I always thought has been fun about the Jazz Quartet is that we very quietly, gently, and gloatingly point out the fascism of the theater. We're here, and we are demanding your attention. And we do that by saying, we're here, and we're demanding your attention, but we're not going to do anything to demand your attention. The simple fact that we're in fucking formal wear. Hi, we're better dressed than you. that just, you know, really, when you think about it, it just has shockwaves and echoes in all sorts of everyday life, and just playing with that and claiming that sort of a power privilege. And we do it in a harmless way. We don't, you know, pick people up and move them around, or we don't, like, hurt them
much.
We're gonna bypass the shrapnel for a moment, but the whole idea that we should that we walk through and we make people get up out of their seats, and we quite literally do demand their attention while standing there doing nothing or sitting in the middle. I mean, the show we did at San Francisco Coffee, where we walked in, drank coffee and ate pastry silently, sometimes looking around. I mean, that to me meant a lot. And it was funny, and, you know, it doesn't make any sort of real overarching, you know, political statement or anything like that. It really does only go as far as a spoof goes, but at the same time, it really does raise a little bit of a consciousness, and people have fun. You know, that's one thing I've always wondered about our shows. Mm-hmm. Whether people are being entertained enough by the silliness of it that they're not paying attention to, you know, a couple of the little buttons that we're actually poking at.
Yeah. Now, that goes back to what you're saying of you really can't control that.
Right.
You know, that's what you'd like, but is it really possible to tease that out on a given setting?
And I think occasionally we've done it. Thank God for little kids. I don't know if you've seen the videotape of the time that we exited the bathroom.
Mm-mm, I haven't.
Oh, it's, yeah, we went in there and flushed the toilets and then just slipped out the back way. And we left the audience sitting there, not sure whether the performance was over or not. And they sat very quietly, politely waiting for something to happen. That went on for a long time and a long time. And finally, Carly, bless his heart, said, "What's going on?" And everybody laughed. They were like, "Oops, we don't know. We were watching these three guys in tuxes, and they left, and we're sitting here waiting quietly so as not to interrupt..."
Nothing.
The nothing. waiting for something to happen.
So,
and if that little kid hadn't done that, I'm not sure the point would have gotten across.
Exactly. When you speak and use the term the theater of absence, what does that mean to you? That's something that we bandy about a lot, but I'm interested in what that means to you.
To me, on the one hand, it is just that genuine sense of demanding attention without offering any focus for it. But there's more to it than that, to me. In a lot of ways, just when you talk about absence, it implies presence. I mean,
okay.
If you say something is absent, you're saying it either has been there or it ought to be there, but it isn't there.
Gotcha.
You know, if I say, "That's elsewhere," then it's elsewhere. If it's absent, it is very directly and pointedly not here.
Right. Elsewhere is different. It doesn't have that same connotation.
Exactly. As soon as you say something is absent, you draw its outline.
Right.
Like presence.
To say that a child is elsewhere is different from saying that a child is absent. That immediately draws up connotations of propriety and where the child should be, or where the, in the case of an item, where the item should be.
Exactly.
Absent is different from elsewhere in the sense that elsewhere means it could be moved back. Absent means something has changed.
Exactly.
Right. Okay. I'm beginning to understand.
I'm very much reminded of actually saints' relics. All over Europe, there are cathedrals of where a saint's finger or toe or lock of hair used to be. I am not kidding.
Okay.
There are shrines to where these things used to be.
And where did they go?
They were stolen and usually taken to other churches.
Yes!
I remember reading about this. There's an anthropologist at... unfortunately, he's at Mount Holyoke, so it's not like I can go study with a guy because he's teaching at a women's college.
Right.
But he wrote just a brilliant paper on the present absence of holy relics in Czechoslovakia, because there are a lot of absent relics in Czechoslovakia, or excuse me, the Czech Republic.
Fascinating.
Yeah. And again, the whole idea of making that a conscious thing for people, of pointing to how often we worship absent things.
So how does the jazz quartet create that absence?
Very often by being absolutely quiet when you'd expect us to do something. We do that. We create absence through silence very often. Standing very still and staring at the audience.
A jazz quartet refusing to make noise is an interesting thing.
Yeah. The sort of we're going to entertain on our time and our schedule.
A jazz quartet where the fourth member is never present.
Exactly. Or if it is, it's a light bagel. You know, to me, there is something very... It points to something very serious. It itself isn't, but it, you know, it does have that. By the way, go out there into your daily life now and see how many times you know you worship absent things.
Signify as a seriousness without actually having to be serious.
Exactly. And just how often we also just completely break the rules of what a stage is, coming in the windows. You know, to me, again, it's really sort of the idea of reminding people that in a lot of ways, this is an agreed upon fiction. And you're agreeing. You can walk down the middle of the street. The cars, the people driving the cars, aren't going to agree with you.
Right.
On the other hand, the people driving the tanks might be a little bit dumbfounded by the fact that you're in the way.
Right. Good point.
And, yeah. Yeah, again, so you've got something very unserious. You've got a guy in a tuxedo crawling in the window. At the other time, on the other hand, he's pointing out, why isn't that a way to get on stage? It's an entrance to this building.
Right.
And you don't have to watch. You know, why are, yes, we faced all of your chairs this way. That's not necessarily where the action is happening. That's just what we told you to do.
So, what is so revolutionary about a coffee maker?
Nothing. For one, it's a running gag. One of the things that I like most about the fact that we make coffee is that making coffee is a symbol of routine. It's the absolutely ordinary thing that pretty much everybody assumes that everybody in this country does.
Common denominator.
Yeah, every day, every morning. And we take it out of its context and say, hey, look at this, here we are. We're doing something that you do every day, but we're better dressed. And we're on stage. We do this through cutting use of flags. And there's the comedian Eddie Izzard talks about how Europe conquered the world through the cutting use of flags.
How so?
We claim India for Britain. But there are 500 million of us here. You can't claim us. We live here. This is our country. Do you have a flag? But no, but it's our country. Well, no flag, no country. According to the rules that I just made up. That's really what we present audiences with in the jazz quartet. You know,
planting little flags in their consciousness.
Exactly. If we do this on stage, it's theater. And it demands your attention.
Even if it's just making coffee.
Yeah. And drinking it.
Or even if it's something repulsive, like putting Tabasco on a Pop-Tart and eating it.
Right.
Right.
You know, any art, or almost any art, most of the art that I can think of, is fundamentally concerned with the gesture that says, look at that, or look at me, or look at, is, well, it says, look, it demands your attention. And the jazz quartet, we play with that all the time. You know, that's what the urinal was all about, Duchamp's urinal.
Mm-hmm.
Look, I put a frame around it.
Therefore it's art.
Yeah. Or here I am demanding your attention to a urinal. What are you going to do about that?
Ooh. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm demanding that you look at this.
The play of the everyday and the play of where the everyday fits into high art. Yeah. And which in its own way is a... It's sort of the opposite of what we were talking about earlier. Instead of instead of making the known place a dislocus, you are dislocusing the known into the unknown. Mm-hmm. In other words, high art is supposed to be this ivory tower that only a few people can aspire to, and you know, it's for the rich and for the elite and for whatever. But if you dislocus a coffee maker or a urinal into the halls of high art or into the halls of theater, mm-hmm. or whatever, then suddenly you've allowed a portal through which the common man can access, the common person can access, the high art experience. And it's an open question for me whether that compromises the high art experience or whether that just democratizes the high art experience without compromising it.
That is a really good question. And what's funny is, you know, back to another thing we were talking about, it's all done by breaking narrative. I mean, that coffee maker is very much in the narrative of this kitchen. Mm-hmm. In the theater, well, I mean, one of the things it does is it's metonymic. It takes the entire narrative of this kitchen with it and juxtaposes it without putting it in the narrative of the theater. It just, it's a paratactic narrative. Parataxis is putting two clauses next to each other without subordinating either one.
Like,
I walked down the street and I saw a man. I didn't see the man because I walked down the street.
Uh-huh.
I didn't walk down the street and then I saw a man.
Not even necessarily there's a connection between these two events.
Exactly.
You could have seen a man a week ago and just not be talking about
that. And in Homeric Greek, I don't think you even need the conjunction. You can just say, I walked down the street, I saw a man. Whereas a hypotactic narrative does subordinate all of its clauses.
I walked down the street in which I saw a man.
Exactly. And one of the most fruitful things you can do, you know, you're presented every day with hypotactic narratives. The history of any country must needs be a hypotactic narrative, especially any government seeking to claim legitimacy will have a hypotactic narrative.
And a flag.
And a flag of why it's in power. Now, say you're in a place where you're forbidden to dispute the hypotactic narrative. So you can't do it at all. What you do in that case is you move right in, right within it, paratactically. Basically, you know, because we are a great country and, you know, we're the supreme rulers of the universe, you know, we have killed these people. You know, just say, well, we killed these people. We're supreme people. You know?
Yeah.
And just the lack of the conjunction there, the lack of the subordination, doesn't make a statement.
But it does, not an overt one anyway.
No. But it does ask a question. It says, fill in the blank. Is there a blank to be filled in? And I think that's a lot of what we do in Jazz Quartet. You know, we take little pieces of this kitchen routine narrative and put them on stage and make people think about them. You know, wait. What?
What was your favorite moment with the Jazz Quartet? What stands out? I mean, I know it's hard to...
Yeah. That's a really tough one to answer. Granted, getting my head shaved was... that may actually have been just for sheer sort of surprise elements. That genuinely was one of my favorite things. You know, it's very easy to focus on some of the moments of shock where we've actually gotten through to people and shocked them. And some of the things we did were just so much ridiculous fun to do. You know, crumple up newspapers and throw them at an audience. That was fun.
Yeah, one of my favorite moments was when you had the audience members shoot rubber bands at me. Because I totally didn't expect that, and it was very disjointing for me. But wonderful. I mean, that's a favorite memory for me. Go ahead.
I'd forgotten about that, actually. I mean, at the time, I was very, very proud of that.
Yeah.
I genuinely don't want to see the fourth wall break down completely and people just storm the stage every time a play comes on and take over and say, nope, we're putting on a play instead of you guys. That's not my objective. But back to favorite jazz quartet moments. When we came in and went out through the windows, that was a really good moment. One of my favorite moments was after the old Pop-Tart routine when, you know, we got done with the Pop-Tarts and we went to play music. And one of the biggest shocks in the world to everybody is that we played melodic, sad, you know, we surprised ourselves.
Yeah.
By...
improvisational, melodic, sad.
Yeah. We grabbed our instruments and produced something that just about everybody listening thought was moving and musical. I really did enjoy playing that trump card too. Oh yeah, by the way, we can be serious, or as serious as it gets. But my favorite moment, okay, was evicting people from the left seat with the bumper sticker. I mean, that... just for total play of theater fascism, time and space manipulation, just the whole nine yards and the taggy commercialism. Here, have a souvenir of your subordination. That I really, really enjoyed witnessing. Yeah, I think that was my favorite jazz quartet moment. God, there've been lots. Either that or Fruit Loops.
When you look back at your experience with the Concept Union, what are you going to be taking with you on your next step to England, and what stays with you?
More than anything, I think what it's going to come down to is sort of this sort of dogged, democratic, a notion of taking art with you wherever you go. Quite literally, I'm going to be taking my paints with me. Mm-hmm. And I'm a little bit curious. More than anything, I'm going to be taking with me the challenge. It's very easy, or it's much easier, when you're in the womb of your best friends, to paint and sculpt and do things that have meaning. And it's also much easier to have a show if you actually have a space where you can show. be taking with me the challenge to continue that sort of a thing when I'm outside of that now. That's really scary. And, you know, I ask myself a lot if I'm actually going to rise to that. I mean, granted, I'm going to be busy, too, but... In a lot of ways, art is all about answering a question with a question. And what I'm going to be taking with me is questions. And I'm going to have to, as I try to figure out what to do with all of it, I'm going to be looking, I'm going to be sort of forced to look back through, you know, all of the art I've produced for the last 3 years. Which is going to be a mental inventory I'm going to be taking with me. See what I like, see what I didn't like, see what needs improving. See what's the dead end I'm done with.